Afternoon, everyone. The Feast of Tabernacles pictures many things for us, fitting as it does into the annual plan of God depicted by the festivals. It pictures for us the coming millennium. As the Feast of Ingathering, it reminds us of the great harvest to come, when all the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord. But for most of us, the millennium will not consist of tame animals, deserts blooming, and making annual journeys to the feast in Jerusalem under threat of drought. That's because these things are all quite physical, and the nature of the millennium will be vastly different for us. Exactly what the nature of that is not always as clear as perhaps it could be. If you turn with me to 1 Corinthians 13, 1 Corinthians 13 and verse 9, we read, "For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect has come, then that which is in part will be done away. When I was a child, I spoke as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know just as I also am known." We're not really quite aware of exactly what it will be like to be spirit. We know what it's like to be physical, and so quite often when we hear sermons during the feast, they're very oriented to what it will be like for the physical humans. In 1 John 3, beginning in verse 1, it says, "Behold what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us, that we should be called children of God. Therefore the world does not know us, because it did not know him. Beloved, now we are children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be. But we know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is." The concept of tabernacles, booths or tents, is intended to also convey to us the temporary nature of our lives as physical beings. And the New Testament frequently uses this analogy. In Hebrews 11, beginning in verse 9, we read, "By faith, he sojourned in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob." This is referring to Abraham. "The heirs with him of the same promise, for he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God." In Hebrews 11:13, it says, "These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth." For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. Abraham and others are pictured here as pilgrims and strangers on the earth, looking and waiting for a different life. Paul referred to our physical bodies as tabernacles or tents as well. In 2 Corinthians 5, and beginning in verse 1, we read, "For we know that if our earthly house, this tent, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed with our habitation which is from heaven, if indeed, having been clothed, we shall not be found naked. For we who are in this tent, in this physical body, groan, being burdened, not because we want to be unclothed, but further clothed, that mortality may be swallowed up by life. Now he who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who also has given us the Spirit as a guarantee. Therefore, we are always confident, knowing that while we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord." Peter, too, used these analogies. In 1 Peter 2, we read, verse 11, "Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul." And referring to the body as a temple, in 2 Peter 1, verse 12, Therefore, I will not be negligent to remind you always of these things, though you know them and are established in the present truth. Yes, I think it is right, as long as I am in this tent, to stir you up by reminding you, knowing that shortly I must put off my tent, just as our Lord Jesus Christ showed me. Moreover, I will be careful to ensure that you always have a reminder of these things after my decease. There are a set of five short books in the Old Testament, which the Jews group together and call the Festival Scroll. Traditionally, they read the Song of Solomon during the days of unleavened bread, Ruth at Pentecost, Lamentations on the Feast of Ab, a traditional fast day, Esther during Purim, and the book of Ecclesiastes on the Sabbath during the 7 days of the Feast of Tabernacles. The book of Ecclesiastes is not especially millennial. It is not a joyous book. In fact, it can be mildly depressing. But it is extremely meaningful in emphasizing this concept of the temporary, empty nature of our sojourn on this earth as pilgrims, pictured by the tabernacles of the feast. For the next few minutes, I would like to read a portion of the beginning of Ecclesiastes out of the Living Bible. I prefer that you not follow along in your own Bible, but instead just sit back and listen to the words of this paraphrase. Beginning in verse 2 of chapter 1, it says, "In my opinion, nothing is worthwhile. Everything is futile. For what does a man get for all his hard work? Generations come and go, but it makes no difference. The sun rises and sets and hurries around to rise again. The wind blows south and north, here and there, twisting back and forth, getting nowhere. The rivers run into the sea, but the sea is never full. And the water returns again to the rivers and flows again to the sea. Everything is unutterably weary and tiresome. No matter how much we see, we are never satisfied. No matter how much we hear, we are not content. History merely repeats itself. Nothing is truly new. It has all been done or said before. What can you point to that is new? How do you know it didn't exist long ages ago? We don't remember what happened in those former times, and in the future generations, no one will remember what we have done back here. I, the preacher, was king of Israel, living in Jerusalem, and I applied myself to search for understanding about everything in the universe. I discovered that the lot of man, which God has dealt to him, is not a happy one. It is all foolishness, chasing the wind. What is wrong cannot be righted. It is water over the dam, and there is no use thinking of what might have been. I said to myself, look, I am better educated than any of the kings before me in Jerusalem. I have greater wisdom and knowledge, so I worked hard to be wise instead of foolish. But now I realize that even this was like chasing the wind. For the more my wisdom, the more my grief. To increase knowledge only increases distress." In chapter 2, he goes on to explain how he tried all sorts of things to see if he could find out what the meaning of life was. In verse 1 it says, "I said to myself, come now, be merry, enjoy yourself to the full. But I found that this too was futile, for it is silly to be laughing all the time. What good does it do? So, after a lot of thinking, I decided to try the road of drink, while still holding steadily to my course of seeking wisdom. Next, I changed my course again and followed the path of folly, so that I could experience the only happiness most men have throughout their lives. Then I tried to find fulfillment by inaugurating a great public works program, homes, vineyards, gardens, parks, and orchards for myself, and reservoirs to hold the water to irrigate my plantations. Next, I bought slaves, both men and women, and others were born within my household. I also bred great herds and flocks, more than any of the kings before me. I collected silver and gold as taxes from many kings and provinces. In the cultural arts, I organized men's and women's choirs and orchestras. And then there were my many beautiful concubines. So I became greater than any of the kings in Jerusalem before me, and with it all I remained clear-eyed so that I could evaluate all these things. Anything I wanted I took and did not restrain myself from any joy. I even found great pleasure in hard work. This pleasure was indeed my only reward for all my labors. But as I looked at everything I had tried, it was all so useless, a chasing of the wind, and there was nothing really worthwhile anywhere. Now I began a study of the comparative virtues of wisdom and folly, and anyone else would come to the same conclusion I did, that wisdom is of more value than foolishness, just as light is better than darkness, for the wise man sees while the fool is blind. And yet I noticed that there was one thing that happened to wise and foolish alike. Just as the fool will die, so will I. So of what value is all my wisdom? Then I realized that even wisdom is futile, for the wise and fool both die, and in the days to come both will be long forgotten. So now I hate this life, or rather I hate life because it is all so irrational, all so foolishness, chasing the wind. And I am disgusted about this, that I must leave the fruits of all my hard labor to others. And who can tell whether my son will be a wise man or a fool? And yet all I have will be given to him. How discouraging! So I turned in despair from hard work as the answer to my search for satisfaction. And though I spend my life searching for wisdom, knowledge, and skill, I must leave all of it to someone who hasn't done a day's work in his life. He inherits all my efforts free of charge. This is not only foolishness, but unfair. So what does a man get for all his hard work? Days full of sorrow and grief and restless, bitter nights. It is all utterly ridiculous. So I decided that there was nothing better for a man to do than to enjoy his food and drink and his job. Then I realized that even this pleasure is from the hand of God, for who can eat or enjoy apart from him? For God gives those who please him wisdom, knowledge, and joy. But if a sinner becomes wealthy, God takes the wealth away from him and gives it to those who please him. So here, too, we see an example of foolishly chasing the wind. So Solomon was quite discouraged, as he observed even that which we accomplish in this life is temporary. This human physical life, while it does have some benefits in training us in being able to be changed to spirit someday, can be a very discouraging time. But it is a temporary time, one that we simply have to endure it for a short time. It is pictured by that symbol of tabernacles, dwelling in tents, of only sojourning for a short time. And for all of us, to some extent, it is more meaningful than the future, which, as I indicated earlier, is likely to be quite different from us than the wonderful human life that is often pictured. I encourage all of you to read the book of Ecclesiastes during the feast. I've only read the first two chapters. There's lots of practical instruction in this book, in spite of its sometimes depressing tone. But also, as you're reading it, take the time to reflect on the vanity of this life and our goal of a better life to come, where our labors will not be in vain, our work will endure, and life will not be temporary. We are to rejoice at the feast, and I'm sure there will be plenty of that. But it is also a time to reflect on the sufferings of this world and focus our intention on the need for God's kingdom to come.